Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to the men and women serving around the world in the service of their country.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
And welcome to another program of Veterans Radio. We're bringing to you live right here on the Ave Maria Network at our flagship studios, WDEO, located in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. Today we're going to have a special program because my partner and guest and host are all going to be in Pittsburgh. That's right. They're covering the Military Writers Society of America. Now, you know, it's getting close to Christmas time, and sometimes it's hard to come up with that gift for that veteran. Well, this will be a good program because we're going to be talking about the military writers and military books. And on the line with me is my partner and host today, live from Pittsburgh, Dale Throneberry. Dale, hello there.
Hey, Bob. How are you doing?
I think we're doing great.
Okay.
How's the volume?
Well, that's the only thing that we're concerned about. But, yeah, we are here at the Military Writers Society of America's annual conference in Pittsburgh. We're at the Airport Marriott. And due to some of our interesting technical issues, we are all in one room, and it looks very interesting.
In whose room are you in?
In mine.
Oh.
All the guests are here. We've got four writers that we're going to be talking to today about their books. They're all nominated for awards through the Military Writers, and I think it's going to be really exciting. We've got books about Vietnam. We've got books about women in the military. We've got some military fiction. So I'm really excited to talk to these guests and to promote their books for them, and also to promote the military writers, because as you said, there's the holiday seasons are coming,
it's
and this
coming.
Is a great opportunity to hear about these books.
So our listeners should have a pencil, paper ready to get information, not just a copy, not the title, but how they can purchase these books. Is that
right,
correct?
Yes. And they need to go to the militarywriters.com, and they'll be able to see photographs of these people and covers of their books and some stories. And I think it's a great site, and it's a great organization. We've got stories, Bob, for the rest of the year as a result of just last night.
Uh-huh. And what do you have today on the Diaz? So
well, first of all,
by the way, it's coming out perfect.
Okay, good.
Good. Thanks. Working fine.
All right. Well, we're going to start off with... I got to go back here to my list. Jack Manick, Jack, better known as Doc Manick, he wrote, his book is called Incoming, and he was a medic in Vietnam. And then we've got Robin Roche Paul, and she's written her book. She was in the Navy, and she writes about what it was like being a mother in the Navy. And then Joe Sanchez, who was also in Vietnam, his book name is True Blue. In addition to being in Vietnam and a Purple Heart recipient, he was also a cop in New York, and his story is really fascinating. I think you'll like that. And then finally, we've got Bob Doerr, who writes military fiction, and he's written a book about murder mystery. He's got a series of books about former military investigators. It's really going to be fun today. I'm excited to talk to these people, and they'll do great. They're all great. I know that.
I think that what we should do is get going forward with the program. Dale, we'll be right back with you right after this message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
You know, with the holiday season coming up, it's good to start making those selections or making your list shorter by doing a little shopping. And what's better to shop for that veteran, very special veteran person on your list, than by going to U.S. Wings. That's right, U.S. Wings. Info at uswings.com. And you're going to be amazed at the selection of clothing, artifacts, equipment, things for that soldier, sailor, Air Force person on your list. That's uswings.com, info at uswings.com. They've got everything there. They've got flight jackets, they have field jackets, they have camo, they have sunglasses, they even have P-38s. When's the last time you thought you could get that one? Hey, folks, that's right. So, you're going to want to go to U.S. Wings. They're in their 25th year of business. They're considered to be the finest authority on authentic flight jackets. And by the way, those flight jackets are not knockoffs. They're not replicas. They're the real thing because they have the patterns. They have the patterns directly from the Air Force, Navy, and the Army. They also do jackets for the English Air Force and for the Australian Army. It's quite the deal. You want to go to uswings.com, info at uswings.com, and when you give them a call, tell them Veterans Radio sent you. And those caissons go rolling, and we're going rolling right around here at Veterans Radio, going back to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Dale Throneberry is at the Military Writers Convention. Dale.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. Yes, we are here at the Military Writers Society in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we're going to be introducing our first guest right now. His name is Jack Doc Manick. And Jack and I actually have a lot in common, but he has written a book about his experiences in Vietnam as an Army medic, and I think it's fascinating. A fellow New Jerseyite, and we don't believe that the Jersey Shore happened either. Jack, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So, Jack, tell me about how did you get involved in being a medic?
I was drafted in 1967, and I wanted to pick what I wanted to do, so in order to do that, I had to volunteer for 3 years, so I volunteered to become a medic. I always wanted to go to medical school, wanted to be a doctor, so I figured this would be a first step.
Yeah, and then what'd you find?
I found out it didn't work out. But being a medic was just a very self-satisfying type of a job in the military, and it was something that I felt that I could make a difference in being a medic, which is why I volunteered to go to Vietnam, so...
And when did you go to Vietnam, and what unit were you with?
I was originally sent to Germany after being at Fort Sam Houston for medical training, and I was working at the 97th General Hospital, and the job was a great job. It was clean. It was almost a non-military position, and I loved it, but I didn't feel like I was accomplishing anything there. So I volunteered to go to Vietnam, and they sent me to the 70th Combat Engineer Battalion in the Central Highlands near Bami Tuit.
You had in your book, if you get the opportunity, folks, you got to go and check out this book. It's called Incoming by Jack Doc Manick, and the table of contents I thought was interesting because it kind of gives you a one sentence description of what's going to happen during that chapter. And again, as I said, I could relate to a lot of the things he was doing because we both flew out of Newark, New Jersey, and ended up in San Francisco, and then 18 hours later we're in 120,000 degrees.
Yeah.
And describe what it was like up in the Highlands. I was not in the Highlands.
It was actually quite a beautiful place, and the temperatures averaged 80 to 90 degrees during the day. Whether it was the monsoon season or the dry season, it didn't make any difference. In monsoon, it was nothing but mud and bugs like you've never seen before, and in the dry season, it was dust and inhaling dust. So it was a very nice place to be, from as long as the war wasn't going on. But I guess there was worse places. So
Yeah, it's like all of those places. You know, if it hadn't been for the war, it would have been a nice place to visit.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, a lot of guys do go back.
Yeah.
And they go back to visit places that they've been before, and the places are where there what once was a combat zone or once was a compound or a big base, now there's farmland. So
tell me a little bit about what your mission was there.
Well, the mission of the engineers that I was with, the combat engineers, I was with two groups. I was assigned to the 70th Combat Engineer Battalion, but the compound that we were in, we also shared it with Vermont National Guard, the 131st Engineer Company. And their both units' responsibility was building fire bases. We got there just after Tet 68, and all the bridges were blown, so they had to either... They couldn't rebuild the concrete bridges, so they put things called Bailey bridges, which were like erector set buildings, bridges. Or they would build bypasses. So their responsibilities were to keep the road structures, the infrastructure going, to build fire bases and anything else that required heavy equipment, bulldozers, cranes, the whole nine yards.
And so tell our audience, especially our civilian audience, because I don't think they understand what a medic's job is.
A medic in the camp, we were at a camp called Camp Swampy, and we were about 50 miles from base camp, and there was two medics, myself and another guy, and we had 300 men that we had to take care of. So they called us Doc because of the fact that we were pretty much the ultimate medical responsibility in the compound. We had a medical doctor, a battalion surgeon, but he was in base camp, which was 50 miles away. So we effectively, I mean, we besides, you know, wounds, cuts, abrasions, you know, the normal things that happen to people, we had to diagnose diseases. We had to prescribe, not aspirin, but, I mean, prescription medications for people, and we had to learn drug treatment. It was what we learned out of Fort Sam Houston as far as medical training. Once we got to Vietnam, even with my training in Germany, you had to relearn everything, and you had to learn new things. So it was being a medic in Vietnam was being like a doctor, which is why they called you Doc.
Yeah, I think in all the branches of the service, they call them the medics.
Yeah, in fact, most of the guys, even the guys that I serve with, they probably don't know my real name. They just called you Doc. So,
well, that's true. Many of us had, you know, names that were endearing and some that weren't quite so endearing, that's for sure. But in addition to your medical duties, though, you were also expected to fight.
Yeah, well, the medic in Vietnam was not like the medic in World War II or Korea where you wore the Red Cross and you were a non-combatant. You were, and in fact, the medic in Vietnam was the number two target of the VC and the NVA. The number one target was the radio man.
Right.
So you couldn't disguise being a medic because you carried an aid bag, which is very distinctive. So they would target us, and one of the problems that we had is they were killing us off so fast that Fort Sam Houston couldn't produce replacements quick enough. So we would take in 11 Bravos, which were infantrymen, and we would try and train them to be medics to the extent that we could for the time that we had. But you know, they were popping us off as quick as we brought them up. So it was not a safe thing to be a medic in Vietnam.
Well, I don't think it was a safe thing to be anything in Vietnam. Yeah. And Trace, we're talking with Jack Doc Manick, the author of his new book is called Incoming, about being an Army medic. And I wanted you to just, if you could just tell us a couple of, or one or two stories of what you did out in the field. You know, how long were you out in the field? And I know when I was talking about guns before, you were fairly well armed for anybody.
Yeah, I believed in carrying as much weaponry as I could. And at the time, we had we were issued M14s, and an M14 is a very heavy weapon.
Yeah.
I wanted to carry as much ammunition as I could besides grenades and other things. And I carried two knives, a Bowie knife and another knife, and I carried three grenades and smoke grenades. And I was looking for a weapon that was light and that I could get a lot of ammo for, and I made friends with a guy in a MACV compound in BAMI 2, a special forces guy, and he got me an M2 carbine, which is an old World War II carbine that was not issued by the military, but that I could I could it was light. I could carry lots of ammunition with it. And I figured I'd give myself more than an even chance if we got into a firefight. So my weapons were not special issued. I mean, they were.
Yeah, I know. I somehow ended up trading for an M79 grenade launcher.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's.
I figured that a 38 caliber just wasn't enough for me.
That'll give you an edge.
That's what I thought, too. The things that I read, are, you know, and just briefly skimming through your book last night, was the, you know, what you had to do in the field, and could you kind of describe some of the medical procedures that you had to go through? I mean, because these guys would get wounded, and then you've got to take care of them and get them out.
Yeah, I mean, if some of the things that happened. I mean, you know, we the guys we would do suturing, we would do all types of work on minor wounds. Anything that was major, we had to call in the medevacs, you know, and have them taken to the field hospitals. But I mean, you name it, anything from fungus to boils. It was an environment where, even with the guys being young guys and being healthy, everybody was coming down with all types of problems, and you know, we had to learn how to treat them. We had one guy got bitten by a snake while he was swimming in a river, which he shouldn't have been doing, and we had no way of knowing whether the snake was poisonous, but most snakes in Vietnam, and especially river snakes, were. So we had to call in a medevac. We had to tourniquet the guy's leg. And the problem was that we didn't have any snake bite kits. They were new, and only the hospitals had it. But the problem with that is, the guy gets bitten by a snake, you've only got so long to get him to a hospital. So I had to tourniquet this guy, and I had to get on a gunship because there was no medevacs available at the time.
Tell us about that gunship.
The gunship. We put the guy on the medevac, and I had to climb in, and I had to go with him because otherwise the pilot wouldn't be responsible for the guy's health, and I understood that. I got on. I was holding on to a center rail that runs from the floor to the ceiling, and the patient was strapped in, and the pilot, if you've ever seen a helicopter take off, the rear end comes up first. It goes up, and then it just kind of slides forward. Well, he went up about 50 feet, and he made I've never seen a helicopter do this, but he made a right-hand turn such that the door was directly beneath me, and I started to slide out of the helicopter, and the only thing that kept me from going out was a bootlace that got caught on the bottom of a seat. And the pilot and the co-pilot turned it back, you know, horizontally. They were having some fun. They were laughing.
I'm sorry. We were a sick group, I know.
It was interesting.
But you know, I'm just fascinated when you're talking about being in the bush or out, you know, on patrols and so on. How long did you go out on these patrols? Was it a day or weeks or
the short term patrols were a day, maybe a day and a half. The long term were upwards of 6-7 days, and the short ones were we were basically could go out 4 or 5 kilometers and circle the camp looking for any evidence that the NVA or the VC had stored weapons there or were coming through that area. We also went out on ambush patrols at night.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go out 5 or 6 kilometers, pick a spot that Army intelligence told us that there might be some activity, and we would set up the ambushes were the scariest things.
I can't imagine being out there in the dark. I mean, I admire you. I admire the infantry so much more than I ever did when I was in the service, when I started thinking about what you guys were doing. In, you know, in the bush, and you know the motto of the Army Aviation is above the finest, and I never really understood that until I started meeting you guys after Vietnam, because I admire what you did. It took a lot of courage to do that stuff.
It was, you know, when you're 22, once you got past the idea that or the frightening idea that you could die there, everything else was just pretty much academic. You just, it was part of your job, and you did it. You didn't really think much about dying, because if you did, you would lose that edge that you
right.
needed to stay alive. So, yeah, the ambushes were crazy. You go out on an ambush patrol, and there's just as likely a possibility that you could be ambushed by the enemy that you ambushing them. So, it was a it was a coin toss when you went out.
Well, sure. You had a couple of incidents while you were in country, and we're running out of time here. I know that already. We'll have to have you back on the program to do a full thing. But military discipline, sometimes, especially to our civilian audience, and this is no offense to the officers of what we call RLOs out there, real live officers, that sometimes when they first got in country, they were a little bit strict about military procedures. So could you just give one quick story about your second lieutenant you ran into?
You're talking Operation Midway or the one where I went to Cameron Bay?
I think it was the one at Cameron Bay, and he didn't like your lack of hat.
We had convoyed from our base to Cameron Bay, and we were ambushed in the pass, the Yang Ming Pass. We lost a man. We got to Cameron Bay, and the first thing we thought about was going to the PX to get something cold to drink. And I had my hat off. I was carrying a non-regulation M2 carbine. And coming from out of the PX was a young second lieutenant with starch fatigues, polished boots, and you could tell he was just out. He had just come in from the States, and I walked by him. I didn't salute him, which I probably should have, but I was not in the mood for saluting anybody. And I got past him, and I heard this voice yelling, "Hey soldier, hey soldier!" And I just kept walking, and I heard, "Hey you without the hat." And he ran up in front of me and stood right in front of me, and he started yelling and screaming at me. Your boots are not polished. You know, your fatigues are filthy. You're carrying an unauthorized weapon, blah, 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 blah. And the first thing I thought about was, well, when you come into any base, you have to unchamber a round out of your weapons. You can't carry a weapon into a major base with a loaded weapon, a loaded rifle. So I chambered a round into the M30, and I picked it up and kind of pointed it in his direction. Didn't say anything, and he looked at me, and his face turned red, and he just walked out of the way, and he just let me pass. But a lot of these young guys that were coming in, they had the wrong concept of where they were. I mean, it was a war zone, and while I probably should have saluted him, he probably shouldn't have done what he did to me. So it was. But it was interesting. I knew nothing was going to come of it. But he was really upset. I never forget looking at his face.
I can certainly understand that. We've been talking with Jack Doc Manick. His book is incoming. You can get it at Amazon. You can go to the Military Writers Society. You can find it on there. I strongly recommend it. And as I mentioned, Doc, we'll have you back on the program later on. I want to thank you so very much for having you on.
Well, I want to thank you for having us on and for coming to pick us up in situations where it was dangerous, and we do appreciate what you guys did as helicopter pilots, so thank you from us to you.
All right, thanks, Jack. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back in just a moment.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Major Patrick Brady rescued 51 men in one day. Details after this. Brady was flying medevac helicopters on his second tour in Vietnam when he volunteered to rescue two badly wounded South Vietnamese soldiers in enemy territory. When he arrived, the site was shrouded in fog. He descended slowly until he saw the tops of trees and then moved sideways to the landing site. Despite heavy enemy fire, he was able to locate the soldiers and evacuated them. Brady was called to another fogged-in area where American casualties lay close to enemy lines. He lowered his chopper through the fog and found a stream bed that led to the wounded. In all, he made 5 flights to rescue 39 GIs. On his third mission, the controls on his chopper were hit, but he managed to get home. He got a replacement chopper and returned. On his fourth mission, Brady watched a mine explode near the landing site, forcing another medevac to leave. Brady went in and set his chopper in the skid marks of the other craft. 2 crew members were carrying a stretcher to the chopper when one stepped on a mine. The explosion blew a hole in Brady's craft. He managed to get it off the ground and delivered the 6 severely wounded men to the aid station. He picked up another helicopter and kept flying. In all, he evacuated 51 men that day. 400 bullet holes were counted in the helicopters he flew that day. Brady went on to become a major general in the United States Army. He was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Nixon on October 9th, 1969.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
You're listening to Veterans Radio on WDEO 990 AM and webcasting at veteransradio.net. Oh, and you're back on Veterans Radio. This is Bob Gould introducing once again Dale Thronberry, your host today from the Military Writers Society of Michigan. Dale, you're there in Pittsburgh.
I am in Pittsburgh. It's the Military Writers Society of America.
America. I'm reading all these little cue cards, but that's okay.
I know. It's all my notes. I apologize for that, Bob. But anyway, yes, we are back here in Pittsburgh, and we are talking with a number of different authors about their books, award-nominated books. Tonight we have the awards dinner, and so it's going to be kind of fun. It's fascinating for me, Bob, always to come down here and meet these amazing authors and their stories. I'm always really fascinated by them. And right now, we've got another author on, a young woman, and we were just talking about that she's probably one of the younger people here at the conference, but we're talking now with Robin Roche-Paul, and she was a United States Navy veteran, and I'll have her talk about that in a second. And all right, audience, you ready for this? Her book is entitled Breastfeeding in Combat Boots, A Survival Guide to Successful Breastfeeding While Serving in the Military. So, Robin, here we are. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So tell me, you told me earlier, but tell our audience, what did you do in the Navy?
I was a mechanic on the A6 intruder, and I was in the early and mid-90s. And as I was explaining to Dale earlier, I was one of the first women to be on the USS Eisenhower when it opened up for women to be out on the combatant ship.
Tell me about that little experience, because I've never been on an aircraft carrier, and I understand
right. There's
5,000 people.
Yeah, there. I mean, you know, they're a floating city, literally. You've got everything. You've got the post office. You've got the flight deck. You've got the barber shop. You've got a grocery store. We joke. Where's the bowling alley on there? You have room. You could probably have one on there somewhere. You've got, 5,000 men, and because they had just opened up for women, there was very few of us that had even cycled into the combat squadrons and whatnot. So there was, I would say, probably barely 500 women, and so, I mean, you can do the ratio there. You know, and because it was still so new, I'd walk down the hangar bay, and I was still getting the guys, their heads were on a swivel watching me walk by. I'd be like, what, you haven't seen a woman before? And I'm decked out in full, flight deck gear, and I don't look like a woman because I've got the big, huge float coat. And if you're not in the Navy and you don't know what that is, it's basically a life preserver, and it's got your strobe light, and it's got, all of this gear hanging off of it. And then I have my own mechanic stuff, and I don't look like a chick under here. I look like one of the guys. My hair was short, and I mean, the hips must have given it away or something, because they've seen you walk by and...
Well, my wife says something. There's something about your kind.
Our kind. But, even beyond that, just I had to fight to be allowed to be up on the flight deck, because they said that I couldn't do the work up there. And I was like, what do you mean I can't do the work up there? I've been doing it all along. I can get signed off, too. Let me up there. And, so there was still a bit of the...
The old school stuff.
But I proved them wrong, and I do have a funny story with that. Once I did finally get qualified and was up there to be a troubleshooter, which is basically I'm the last person to look at the plane before they shoot it off the catapult, and the guys made me wear, because I was barely 100 pounds sopping wet at that point, and they would make me wear the tie down chains, which are when you're on the carrier, when the planes are landed and stopped, they chain them onto the carrier so that they don't fly off.
Right.
And they're pretty heavy, and they would make me wear a couple of tie-down chains around my waist so that I wouldn't get blown off the
right.
off the deck, because when those birds turn, especially because we still had the F-14s at that time, when they go to full afterburner before they're going to take off, yeah, you can take a tumble and go right off the back end. I wasn't going to say back end. The back
the
end
stern.
Of the ship. The stern. No, I was going to use another
I know.
Term.
Well, we can't do that, Bob.
No.
You don't have that delay switch.
No, we don't.
No, not a problem.
That's
all right, so you were in the Navy. You are on an aircraft carrier. You're one of 500 women with 5,000 guys. But then, you know, you got married.
I got married. Yes,
I
did.
But you're still in the Navy.
But I'm still in the Navy.
And your husband is a pilot.
No, he's not a pilot. He's air crew. He's enlisted.
Okay.
He's still in. He's a chief now.
All right. Because I guess reading the thing, I saw A6, and I'm going, that's an airplane, isn't it? I think so.
Yeah. No, he's on the C2.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So anyway, so you're married.
Yes.
And then you decided, time for children.
Time for children. And I was a good girl. I waited until my shore duty rotation. I wasn't going to go and get pregnant so that I get out of a deployment, because
mm-hmm.
that really irks the men and the other women. And I agree. I don't like it when I find women are getting pregnant so they can get out
right,
of
yeah.
having to go someplace. That's
but
not
there
right.
Were, but true. But there were some issues involved with that once you know, when you were pregnant or after your child was born, wasn't there?
Well, there's
that
issues.
That resulted in the book.
There's issues just because, you know, with the pregnancy, I was still an aircraft mechanic, even though we were on shore duty. And so they can't have me around the hazardous materials because all the hydraulic fluid and all of that kind of stuff. They didn't know. I swear they still don't know exactly how much of it can get to the fetus. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, when you're breastfeeding, can it get through the milk? We kind of really don't have those sorts of answers. So that kind of takes you out of mm-hmm. what your MOS is. And,
right.
you know, then somebody else has got to fill your spot in. And even now with the new policies that are in place, and keep in mind when I was in, there were no policies
mm-hmm.
regarding pregnancy and breastfeeding. Now the services have policies. The Navy gives you a 12-month deferment from being deployed after your baby is born. The Air Force, Army, and Marines all give 6 months, which makes sense. Their rotation is,
mm-hmm.
you know, much, much quicker. Coast Guard is 6 months as well. But when I was in, that wasn't
mm-hmm.
in place. But even though with these policies in place, that's only for long-term deployments, like, you know, a six-month deployment on the
right.
ship or getting rotated over to Afghanistan or something like that. That doesn't cover exercises. That doesn't cover the short little 1 and 2 week hops where you just go out and, you know, do an exercise out in the ocean or
mm-hmm.
they send you out for field training or something like that. It doesn't cover that. So you still have moms that have got, let's say, a three-month-old, and she has to go on
You're
a
gone.
Field training exercise for 2 weeks.
So this motivated the idea, this breastfeeding
combat. This is what motivated, because I had to deal with getting sent out to, like, Fallon, Nevada, when they do their training exercises out there for the Navy
mm-hmm.
and you know, are out on board the ship for 1 or 2 weeks. And I just kept hearing from friends and coworkers and stuff, what do I do? What am I supposed to do? I've still got a baby at home, and...
Mm-hmm.
I need to feed the baby. I need to. How do I stockpile my milk? What do I do? Help! So yeah, I thought to myself, well, once I got out of the Navy and I went back to school and got my bachelor's degree and got my certification as a lactation consultant, I figured I've got the expertise because I've got the book-based knowledge
right.
where I can help these moms. I can answer these kinds of questions, but I've got my own experience. I did this
mm-hmm.
when I was in the military. And so that was the impetus for writing it, and
Well, we're talking with Robin Roche Paul, who wrote the book. It's called Breastfeeding in Combat Boots, A Survival Guide to Successful Breastfeeding Moms. I added that, while serving in the military. And your name at the bottom of the book, and I should probably show it. For those of you who are watching our webcast, we're just sitting here talking on phones and the screen's going black. That's all right. Once you did get out, you went back to school.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned then you became a certified...
lactation consultant.
Okay, but now you're working on another degree.
I'm back in school to become a nurse.
Ah.
So I've got even more of the medical... Eventually, I'm going to be a nurse practitioner, and I don't want to bore your listeners with all of that, but this will allow me to do even more. If a mom has a problem, I can diagnose and actually give her medication if she needs it and that sort of thing.
Okay.
Where right now, I can kind of just say, well, yeah, we think this is what's the matter, but you got to go talk to your doctor.
Well, in the book, what is it that you want the moms to take out of your book? What's a lesson they need to know?
What's a lesson they need to know is that they can do this with the proper information and support. It's definitely doable. My book is full of not only the how-tos, but I've got stories from moms that contacted me to let me know what they did and how they made it work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorites is the mom that was sent to Afghanistan when her baby was 6 months old, and she was able to pump while she was over there and ship her milk back home to her baby.
Wow.
Until she got back when he was a little over a year old. And, you know, so it's stuff like that where when I tell moms, look, this is how she made it work, this is what she did, and we go through the steps and the things that she did to do that, and they go, oh, wow, I never knew that I could do that. So many of them think that they can't do it once they get past their 6 weeks of maternity leave, so they just quit. And they don't even make the effort to even try.
Okay. Well, I'm coming up. I've got another break here. But I would, I know you have a website and you've got some other information. Can you let's hear them so people can go.
Okay. Ahead. The website is www.breastfeedingandcombatboots.com. Made it. It's a pain to type that all in, but there you go. And I've got everything. I've got the policies that moms can, they're in PDF format so they can download them. Because that's another thing. A lot of these moms don't even know where to find the information,
sure,
even within their own service. So they can get the policies online. They can contact me. I answer my emails. And, you know, so if they've got a question. And I also have a Facebook fan page for the book. And that's wonderful because a lot of the moms interact with each other. So if you post a question on there, other mothers will answer you
right
back and say, this is what worked for me.
Well, it's significant and it's important. And Robin Rose Paul, thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be right back after this, Bob.
Okay.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu. Or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
You're listening to Veterans Radio on WDEO 990 AM and simulcast at veteransradio.net. And we're back on Veterans Radio. Bob Gould here at the station in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. But now back to Dale Thronberry in Pittsburgh covering the Military Writers Society of America. I got it right that time.
Absolutely, Bob. Thank you very much. Yes, I'm talking about beautiful downtown Pittsburgh. We're on the outskirts of Pittsburgh right now, but it's, and the sun will shine someday. But it's all right. Yes, we are here, and we are talking to a number of writers today, and probably we picked up some guests for later on this season on Veterans Radio. And right now I want to welcome Joe Sanchez to Veterans Radio. Joe has written a book entitled True Blue, and it is a tale of the enemy within. And Joe was, I'll let Joe introduce himself. Joe, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning, Vietnam.
You know, we always have to get one of those at least. So Joe is from New York, and so this weekend has been really fun. I've been bonding with a lot of East Coasters, and my accent's coming back like I can't believe. It's really fun. But so, Joe, you're from New York?
Yes, I am.
And you got... Tell me about how you got into the service, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for your service to America. I want to thank the good Lord Jesus Christ for getting me through life and getting me to this point where I have the pleasure of meeting you.
My pleasure also. So...
Well, to begin with, I was born in Puerto Rico in 1947, came to the mainland in 1952 when I was about 5 years old. I moved to the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and my mother and moved us around to the Bronx. After finishing high school, I tried to get into the service. I tried to join all the branches, but as I wrote in my book, I had trouble getting into the Marines, the Navy, the Air Force.
Well, how big were you then?
As far as tall-wise?
Weight-wise.
Oh, I weighed about maybe 120 pounds, okay. You know, 5 foot, almost 5'7".
What do you think the problem was? What was the difficulty?
Well, I was arrested when I was 12 years old.
That'll
you know?
Do it. Okay.
Yeah, I was arrested when I was 12 years old. You know, there were two other individuals older than I was, another Puerto Rican kid and an Irish kid. And they asked me to, if I can get a screwdriver for them, you know, and
yeah.
Up in my apartment, I got it for them. They asked me to escort them to where they were going. I didn't know what they were going to do. They were trying. They were attempting to pry
yeah.
open a parking meter, and a cop came by and locked us up.
There you go.
Yeah.
I can understand that
mm-hmm.
one. Okay. So anyway, you finally got...
I was able to push my draft. I was able to push my draft.
Okay.
I went to Fort Dix. I wanted to be a paratrooper, but I was sent to Fort Carson, and that's where the 57th came out of, and they were sent to Vietnam. And but I arrived in Vietnam first. I arrived to Vietnam as an artillery. My MOS was artillery. I served with the 2nd of the 20th Aerial Rockets Artillery gunships. And when the 57th finally came in, I volunteered for the infantry. I went into A Company as a rifleman.
And you were there when?
66 to 67.
Okay, and so you were also in 2 Corps in, mm-hmm. in the Central Highlands.
Yes, I was. We served in Bong Son, Quy Nhon. I also served in Phan Thiet. But I got transferred from the... they started giving out transfers, so I left the 5th to the 7th, and I went to Phan Thiet. And I was assigned to D Company, 2nd of the 7th, as a forward observer. And in January 16th, 1967, it was my birthday. And I remember that day. We left early morning. We went to check a VC camp.
Mm-hmm.
It was getting dark, you know. Well, not getting up, but it was about 4 o'clock. And we heard that they were serving chicken at LZ, Virginia.
Huh.
And we knew we would never make it back by you know, hiking it back. So the lieutenant had the idea, the squad lieutenant, that to call in the birds. They called in the birds. They picked us up, dropped us off back to Virginia. I had my chicken, hot meal, and I started writing my mother a letter, as everybody, you know, as my other friends were doing. I was telling my mom I was in no way was I in danger. You know, I used to tell I was a clerk. And just then there was an activity 4 miles away. Another platoon made contact with the VCs, and being a forward observer with Sergeant Fred Booker, I had to get my PRIC 25 back on, and we were picked up, went into a village firefight, and I would say maybe about 10 minutes later, as we're searching a VC, a grenade at us, and four of us were seriously injured. And they medevac. I got medevac and to a fuel hospital, and
mm-hmm.
from then on, I went to Nha Trang and to get operated on. And that was my experience as far as being wounded. I mean, I can go on with other.
Did they send you home, or did you go back to the field?
No, I was in the hospital for a few weeks. And the other, the medic, Robert Martinez, he was seriously injured. He was sent back home. He had about about 16 operations to get him back, you know, back on his feet again. Fred Booker was sent back home also, and he spent about 6 to 8 months in the hospital. And I was able to make contact with them back in '97 when everybody started getting their computers.
Yeah.
And I was able to find lost friends, and it felt so good to make contact with these lost friends.
Sure.
And that's my experience about a little. What I've told you is a little bit of my experience in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But then came the concrete jungle. I went to another war.
Well, yes. Well, we're talking here with Joe Sanchez. His book is called True Blue. And if you just go in and Google Joe Sanchez on you'll find a lot of information about him, because we're doing this in a very condensed version today. Joe, we'll have you back on again to talk about it more. But you went from one war zone to another war zone. Tell me about the other war zone you went to.
Yes, I always wanted to be an NYPD police officer. Now, again, I had trouble getting into the NYPD, so I had the opportunity to serve with the Port Authority, New York, New Jersey Port Authority Police. I spent 3 years with them, and it was a very interesting job. I loved it, but I always felt like I was a grunt. So I had taken the tests for the NYPD in 68, but there was a freeze, and I had problems, again, getting in.
Okay.
Finally, after 3 years with the Port Authority, I was called in 73 to become a New York City police officer. I entered the academy in 1973, and I loved it. My first assignment was in Brooklyn. But I tell my story because it's hard. I broke the police code of silence.
Mm-hmm.
A few few years later down the road, I was arrested and indicted in 1983.
Let's back up just a second. You witnessed and saw some things that wasn't kosher, to put it mildly, and you reported it to your superiors.
Yes. Well, as a police officer, we see a lot of corruption, and
right.
You just don't tattletale and say, I saw this. You got to work with these fellas. They're your backups.
Right.
And I work with a lot of good, honest cops, but there were those I stayed away from. But I had an incident where my partner and I, we follow one individual into a tenement building. We suspected, the guy was into no good drugs. And as we quietly follow him up into a flight of stairs, this individual goes into an apartment. We figure we had nothing going, but we heard somebody else coming up. So we tippy-toed up to the next flight where we could observe the second individual
right.
coming up, knocking on the door. The door was open, but this is a drug location. And what happens is, when you're in a drug location, there's a security guy. He's got a gun. His job is to let the buyers come in, escort them in, buy your stuff out. When he opened up the door, we saw the gun. We rushed the guy. He saw us coming. He tried to close the door on us, but we were able to overpower him. He dropped the gun. I called for backup. 1013 officer needs help. We grabbed the one individual that was knocking at the door. But he was able to bolt the guy with the gun. We were able to secure him. As I entered the apartment, there were other individuals in the apartment. The fellow we were following was there. There was drugs. And when it was all over with, one of the individuals in the apartment claimed that I took his money. When Internal Affairs investigated, five of the other individuals that we arrested backed my story up that I never took any money.
Mm-hmm.
And Internal Affairs more or less closed the case as unsubstantiated. But I had made enemies. I ratted out a corrupt lieutenant. He had more friends than I did. What they did was they reopened that investigation, and these other individuals, six of the drug dealers that were facing 3 to life, the only way out they could get out of it was to say that I took money from all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I wound up getting indicted. Now, my partner, I wound up getting indicted. And it took me a while to clear my name. I was exonerated, but I was... Eventually, when I was fired from the police department,
mm-hmm.
but when I was exonerated, it was hard getting back on the job, and that's what my story is about, trying to get back on the job, and I could never get back on the job. I became a New York State correction officer. That's another story.
Another story. And unfortunately, our time is running short again,
mm-hmm.
Joe. This is a great book. You guys out there, you got to check this out. This is one man's journey through life and coming up against a lot of unusual experience.
They'll love my website. They'll love my website.
Where is that?
www.bluewallnypd.com. www.bluewallnypd.com. It's a good website. You'll like a lot of music. And my co-author is Mo Dania, by the way.
Okay. Joe Sanchez, the book is True Blue. Check it out. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're back on Veterans Radio. Bob Gould from the studios in Ann Arbor, Michigan, inviting you to... Let's go back to Dale Thronberry in Pittsburgh. Dale.
Hey, thanks, Bob, very much. We are here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with the Military Writers Society of America. And my next guest is Bob Doerr, and he is a writer also. He writes military fiction. And, Bob, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Well, thanks a lot. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, of course, everybody that's on this program, well, I take that back. 90% of the authors here have military backgrounds, and you do also. Can you tell me a little bit about what you did while you were in the service?
Sure, Dale. I spent nearly 30 years in the Air Force, and all of it was the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Most people haven't heard of we call it the OSI, but they've heard of NCIS because of the television show.
Right.
And the OSI is like a sister agency, very same mission as the NCIS, but it's in the Air Force. And I like to tell people, if you've seen the show, then you know what
NCIS is, but at the same time, on the TV show, obviously, real NCIS isn't like that. So we're not like that either, but we're still a sister agency.
Okay, and so your job, we talked briefly this morning, you were all over the world, it sounded like.
Right. It's in the regular Air Force, so you end up going around the world wherever they are. That's where we were assigned. I had assignments in Korea and Thailand and Germany and Spain, and then in four or five different locations in the United States along. I had one assignment at the Pentagon.
Without breaking any security, can you tell the type of cases that you worked on?
Actually, the mission is just like the FBI. More people are probably familiar with the FBI. Any kind of felony that takes place involving the Air Force, either being committed by an Air Force member or against the Air Force, and the OSI has a role in it. We also have a counterintelligence mission, counterespionage, counterterrorism, that type of stuff. And I first several years did criminal, and then for most of my career, I was more focused in the counterespionage arena.
That's fascinating to me. So what did you find out in that? Anything that you can tell our audience that you were able to uncover?
Most of it, I guess, we can't really talk too much about it, but it's your, you know, we look for spies or people trying to do evil things against the U.S. and the Air Force all over the world. We worked with, what was really interesting from my personal opinion, is I got to work with a lot of foreign agencies, various criminal and security agencies in all those countries, Germany, Spain, you know, Korea. So you got to see the rest of the world and how other people did the same things you did, and learn a lot about the world and history, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that's one of the things that you guys that stay in the military for a longer period of time get to see get to see the world and expose yourself to all these different cultures.
You're right. I think a lot of people who like the military like that travel, like to go around, and perhaps a lot of people that get out earlier, people who are more the typical type person and wants to stay close to home and by family. I grew up in a military family, so I was, and so did my wife. So we were used to bouncing around every 3 or 4 years, and that's how we spent our first 50 years, just two or 3 years in one spot, and you move on. And I really enjoyed it.
So then, after this career, you started another career.
Right.
You're a writer now.
I'm an author. I have 3 books that are published. One more that will be released. I don't know the exact date, but my publisher told me probably in October or November of this year.
So tell me about the one that we're talking about right now. Is called Loose Ends
Kill. Loose Ends Kill. It's a murder mystery, a mystery thriller. Setting is in San Antonio, Texas, which happens to be where I'm from. I have the same main character in all my books, but they're not a sequel, so you can read them in any order. They're all standalone stories. The first two took place in New Mexico, and Loose Ends Kill, like I said, takes place in San Antonio. My protagonist, a guy named Jim West, is a retired OSI agent.
Surprise.
Yeah, I guess a lot of the we authors.
Write what you know.
Yeah, and he's an individual who spent 20 years in OSI and ended up retiring at 20 at the same time and really motivated because he went through a messy divorce. It was a divorce he never saw coming, and it really bothered him. So he left the Air Force after 20 years and moved back to New Mexico, really just to do as little as possible and live out his life in peace. And what happens is he keeps getting sucked into different murder investigations, even though he's trying not to. In Loose Ends Kill, what happens, he gets a phone call from some lawyers in San Antonio saying that an old friend of his needs him and wants him to come down and talk to him. In essence, the friend was arrested for murdering his wife and is claiming that he's innocent. And that's, in essence, how he gets sucked into the whole investigation.
And so this is a series of articles, but you said, I mean, a series of books, but they're also standalone stories,
right,
each one.
Right. The only repeat characters in the books are the protagonist, Jim West, and his dog, Chubbs, is in each one. All the other characters are new each time.
How did you start writing, I guess?
I think I've always been a storyteller and writer, and I actually wrote my first book years before I even tried to get it published. And I've done a lot of short stories for my family. I used to write short stories for each of my children when they got old enough to read. And I did the same for my grandchildren. And finally, when I stopped working, I decided I'd try and get serious with it. And that's what I've been doing.
Well, if you'll tell me a little bit about how, and this is just for our general audience because we have a lot of potential authors out there, I know. How do you go about getting that book published, or how do you find a publisher?
It's not easy, and I understand it's even harder these days than it has been in the past because of all the changes in the industry. But to find a publisher, you really just have to start writing letters. You can either write them to smaller independent publishers, or you can write them to literary agents and try to find an agent that will get you into a big publisher. And you just have to have tough skin because it's very normal to have many, many, many rejection letters. I think I had over 75 or 80 rejection letters, and these are from people who I got the letter back, it seemed like 2 days after I sent my query letter, asking them if they would like to look at my manuscript. And I was just lucky finally to land a small publisher who, when he saw my manuscript, he liked it.
And where can we get this book?
This book is available on Amazon, on BarnesandNoble.com, on various online stores, so a number of smaller bookstores, some Hastings and independent stores might have it. I know a couple of base exchanges had it too. So it's online. The easiest place, if you have a computer, is go online, like to Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com, and you can either get a hard copy mailed to you or picked up at the store or on your Nook or Kindle.
Okay. Bob, how much time have we got? He's not, I can't hear him. I think we've got a couple.
Well, we're setting up the board. We have about 1 minute as of right now.
I thought that would... I didn't know if my watch...
No, we're setting up the board.
Okay. Well, Bob Doerr, the author of Loose Ends Kill and a couple of other books with the same character in there. I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio and hope to have you on again sometime in the near future.
Well, thanks, Dale. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. All right, Bob, that's going to be about it from Pittsburgh, but I wanted to talk just, if I have about 30 seconds, to encourage everyone to go to the militarywriters.com, their website. There's a lot of great information in there, especially if you want to become a writer. And they can help you, and as Bob and I talked earlier this morning, he talked about the idea that there are people in this organization that can help you find that publisher and go forward. And if I hear the music in my ear, that means that we're just about ready to say goodbye. And next week we're going to have Bob Calvert on, and Bob produces a number of videotapes called Talking with Heroes. He's been to Afghanistan and Iraq, and he's going to be on next week to talk with us. So until next week, Bob, I will see you in a couple of days. But to our audience, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC. Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.